Today's Bible reading is found in Exodus chapter 14, verses 19 to 31, found on page 65. The angel of God, who was going before the Israelite army, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud moved from in front of them and took its place behind them. It came between the army of Egypt and the army of Israel. And so the cloud was there with the darkness, and it lit up the night. One did not come near the other all night. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea. The Lord drove the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. The Israelites went into the sea on dry ground, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. The Egyptians pursued and went into the sea after them, all of the Pharaoh's horses, chariots, and chariot drivers. At the morning watch, the Lord, in the pillar of fire and cloud, looked down upon the Egyptian army and threw the Egyptian army into a panic. He clogged their chariot wheels so that they turned with difficulty. The Egyptians said, "Let us flee from the Israelites, for the Lord is fighting for them against Egypt." Then the Lord said to Moses, "Stretch out your hand over the sea, so that the water may come back upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots and chariot drivers." So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and at dawn the sea returned to its normal depth. As the Egyptians fled before it, the Lord tossed the Egyptians into the sea. The waters returned and covered the chariots and the chariot drivers, the entire army of Pharaoh that had followed them into the sea. Not one of them remained. But the Israelites walked on dry ground through the sea, the waters forming a wall for them on their right and on their left. Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Israel saw the great work that the Lord did against the Egyptians, so the people feared the Lord and believed in the Lord and in his servant, Moses.
Usually on a Sunday morning on my way over here, I crank my music up. This morning I was listening to The Doors, and I often listen to Led Zeppelin or, you know, some other of my favorite music, and then come here and sing some of our dreary hymns. Oh, I like a lot of our hymns, and you know, a lot of my music that I like wouldn't work in here anyway, so it's not very worshipful. Well, how many people have seen the movie The Ten Commandments with Charlton Heston? How many of you seen it? How many of you saw it when it first came out on the big screen? Oh, yeah. Wow, see, we're dating ourselves. Now, what year was that it came out?
I think they projected it on a cliff.
They projected it on a cliff. Out in the desert, right? Yes, I know. I don't even remember what year that came out. I was very young when it first came out. And, of course, because I saw it when I was young, I always see Charlton Heston when I hear about Moses. I can't imagine Moses looking like anything other than Charlton Heston. It's in my memory. Of course, this is one of the most famous stories in the whole Bible, and which means it is really hard to preach on. Because it is so obvious and even a little heavy-handed dramatically. I mean, it is so dramatic that I think even with our special effects in movies today, it still could not match the drama of this great, great story. We might even call it the founding story of Israel. It is the story that they always look back on when they think about how God has saved them. It's the story they look back on when they think about their history and their origins. And they remind themselves that they all came from slavery. In fact, that's probably what the word Hebrew means. It means it was probably a derogatory term like wetback or something like that. You know, you come across the Rio Grande from the south because you come from poverty. Well, these Israelites have a great memory because they were in Egypt for 400 years. That's a long time to remember back. And of course, by the time they get to the promised land, it's another 40 years. And by the time they get to King David, it's even much later. So it's amazing. These people have such a long, long memory. But that's how things worked back then. These things were passed on orally. It was part of the oral tradition. And I could easily imagine people gathering in the evening around the campfire after a meal and then hearing these great stories. In fact, a lot of these stories were enshrined in the holiest days of the year. And even to this day, the Jews gather on Passover and the oldest son asks the father, why is this night so important to us? And the family tells the story once again about the Passover. And this has been going on for years, for decades, for centuries, for millennia. These stories have been passed down. And of course, later on, they were written down in the form that we have them now. But these stories are much, much older than the written form for which we have them. And of course, people saw it not simply as history. They didn't understand history in the same way that we do. When you take a history class, you learn dates, you learn wars, you learn generals, you learn about all of that stuff. And we think history is factual. Now, I grew up hearing about our founding fathers, and I grew up hearing that it was a historical fact that George Washington chopped down a cherry tree. Now, do you remember being taught that? How many were taught that in school? See, that was taught as fact. Of course, we've since learned that, you know, that's apocryphal, but it goes to the point, you know, that he was an honest man. So the historical fact might not be true, but the characteristic that it points to might very well have been true. And so even our sense of history these days is pretty loose. In fact, there are books that come out all the time kind of updating on this president or that president. I think Ken Burns is doing a series on the Roosevelts. And, of course, new material is coming out, and we're learning new things about it. So history is a very dynamic thing. It's not settled. And history is also usually told by the winners, not always. Sometimes history is adapted by those who are in slavery, and that's why the slaves in this country for a long time saw Moses as their leader, and they took on this great story of the Exodus as their theme because they saw themselves as slave, which way they were. They were in abject poverty, and they were slaves, and they were worth only the price that someone was willing to pay for them in order to work. And that went on for hundreds of years. And so there was a slave class here in this country. We don't have to go all the way back to the Hebrews. All we have to do is look in our own history books and realize that there was a very, very important slave class that adopted this story as their own. And you can get all kind of different spirituals, different songs that were heard out in the cotton fields in the heat of the day in order to let the hours pass. People would make up songs about Moses and Pharaoh, and they would make up songs about the Exodus and the time in the desert and the time in slavery. And so this is an old story, but it is as new as it is today, because there are probably more slaves today in the world than there were slaves back in Egypt in that world. So slavery is with us in all its many, many forms. Now, this story that Sharon just read to you is at the very end, actually. It's a transitional story. It is the grand escape. It is the grand exodus. And there is a story that leads up to this. In fact, there are 13 chapters in Exodus before the text that we get today. And this is the problem of taking these stories out of context. If you just read this story without the context, then you don't really get a sense of how important the story is. And this is after a very long process of Moses working with and against Pharaoh to try to gain the release of the Hebrews. And, of course, they wanted to go out into the desert to worship their God, and their God had a name, and the name of that God was Yahweh. And whenever you see the word Lord in the text, that's a mistranslation. Lord is a title. It's actually for the name Yahweh. So whenever you see the word Lord in the text, just say Yahweh. It was not the Egyptian God. It was not the sun god. It was the God of the desert. And so these people were called out into the desert. And here, it's one of those border stories. You're on the border. You're on the river. You're on the lakeside. You're ready to cross over. And we've been through this in the Gospel of Mark, where going over is a big theme in Jesus' life, going over to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. In this case, it's going over the boundary. Of course, a lot of speculation is spent on where, geographically, this might have happened. People, of course, it's called the Red Sea in the text. We think it's the Red Sea. It probably wasn't. It was probably referring to the reed swamplands, something like that. But if you go looking for the location of this story, you're kind of missing the point. Number one, you're not going to find it. And number two, if you did find it, it wouldn't make any difference to the story, because the story stands on its own terms, and it is a metaphorical story. It has a much deeper meaning than just the historical fact of it. And so here we have, on one side of wherever this water is, on the Egyptian side, they are slaves. And you might notice in the story that Yahweh had Moses lead them to a place near the water where there was no escape. Now, Yahweh did this on purpose, and you know what that purpose was? So that everyone, including the Egyptians and the whole world, would see how God saved the Israelites. There was no possibility for them to save themselves. That was the whole point. So on one side, there they are, slaves, cowering. They're watching Pharaoh and his chariots gaining on them. And, of course, there's this famous story about the parting of the water. Of course, if you watch the movie, it all happens fairly quickly, but in the story it says the east wind blew all night and was more of a process. And of course, these people crossed dry land to the other side. And of course, the chariots follow. And the story itself is a little confusing. You wonder what action God is doing and what action Moses is doing. It's a little difficult to distinguish one from the other. You wonder, is God doing anything in this story directly? It's a little hard to know, because God is doing all of this through Moses. In the story, of course, Moses holds up his, Charlton Heston holds up his staff, and you know, the water comes crashing, and of course the whole army, the Egyptian army, is destroyed, and the bodies are washing up on the shore, and they are standing there, the people of Israel. They have actually done nothing. They have done nothing. All they've done really is complain, if you read the story. They're in a fix. They blame Moses for getting them out into the wilderness where they don't know how to live. And they're ready to go back to Egypt because at least they know that they're going to have food back there and shelter, at least that. And they accuse Moses of taking them out into the desert in order for them to die. They say, "What, Moses, weren't there enough graves in Egypt for us? Did you have to take us out here to bury us?" And there's a lot of complaining. And so it's obvious that the people of Israel had nothing to do with their own escape, so to speak, except take the step. And they took the step from one side of the water all the way to the other side of the water, and they were transformed by it. Now, this feels a lot like a birthing experience. And I think that might be a good way to look at this story, as a birth. Now, that's how Jesus often saw death. He saw death as a lot like childbirth, where you are in one world, and in that world you know what the lay of the land is. These people knew that if they went back to Egypt, they could survive there, even though they were in slavery. And they had no idea what was on the other side of this clear path through the water. And of course, they go through that path, and as the water closes in on the Egyptians, they stand on the other side as free people. There is so much drama in the story, it's hardly to over-dramatize it. From one side of that narrow passageway through the water to the other side, their lives have been totally transformed. On one side, they were enslaved to the Pharaoh. On the other side, they became the children of Yahweh, Yahweh's people. And now, here I am, I thought about this, reading this story, preaching about slavery. I am a white male living in one of the richest countries in the world, speaking about slavery, and I really have no right to speak about slavery, and I'm not sure any of us do. We tend to psychologize this. We talk about ways we are in bondage and how to get out of bondage. There is some legitimacy about using the story in that way. But for those who are literally slaves, this has a much deeper meaning to them than it does to us. Now, I have to say that it doesn't matter what color we are or where we live what circumstance we are under, there are times in life when we feel like there is no option for us. There is no exit. There is no pathway. There is no way out. And I think that is probably one of the main factors behind why people end their own lives, is because they do not see an out. They don't see a passageway. And there are many circumstances in life when we get to that point. Divorce is a great example of, we don't see any path forward. And many of us have experienced that. There are times when we're in the grip of that sense of loss of that relationship, when it feels like we can't even see a path forward. When we are very, very ill, facing a serious illness, and the doctors do what they do, and the medications, do what they do. But there are moments when there is no pathway forward except through death. When you experience the death of a child, or the death of a very, very close spouse or friend, there seems to be no path out of that. If you experience deep depression, and you can see the psychiatrist any number of times, and they can try out all different kinds of antidepressive medicines on you, and yet there is that pit, and that's what depression is all about. There is no way out, and the only way out is by your own hand. And here in this story, the people of Israel, the slaves, are in a position where literally there is no way out for them. It is either the advancing army or it is the water behind them, and there is no passageway. And of course, God is the one who creates that passageway. There is that phrase that we've used several times here, that God creates a way out of no way. That can sound a little like a cliche. That can sound easy. That can sound like a mystification. When you're in the grip of a no way out, it's hard to believe that God is the one who creates a way out of no way. But going back to the story, the people had a choice. They had a choice. There was a way made for them. They could have gone back to Egypt. They could have surrendered. They could have waved the white flag, and Pharaoh would have gladly taken them back into slavery to continue building their empire, because without slaves, there would be no empire. But instead, they turned their back on the advancing army, and they took that first step on that land that was once water, and they made their way through this dangerous passageway into a world they had no way to anticipate or imagine. That's what they did. They stepped out in faith. And then, of course, that's the whole point, is that they were forced to trust Yahweh. If they could build their own bridge, it would have been a different story. It would have been about how heroic they were and how brave. But the story is told in such a way that this passageway was not created by them. It was created by Yahweh, and that's the whole point. The point being that we can trust Yahweh to create a way out of no way. And that's what birth is all about. That's what death is all about. Every transformation, I say, requires a death. Every new life requires a death. And so we are all in that process of letting things go and receiving new things as they come along. And no matter who you are or where you are in your own life, this story can be a very powerful story for you. Because how many times do we feel stuck in life? I feel stuck all the time. I can't even count the number of times during the day I feel totally stuck. I've been to see my psychiatrist I don't know how many times. I've tried Prozac, I've tried Lexapro, I've tried, well, you name every one of them, I've tried them all. And, well, you know, what it comes down to for me is that I read these stories. A story like this has a more positive effect on me than medication does. A story like this gives me more hope than anything I can conjure up on my own terms. A story like this I keep in mind when I'm in the doctor's office or the psychiatrist's office or in my little office at home, staring at the screen of my computer, wondering what's going to come. What words? What words? So, yeah, as a white male living in the largest, most richest country in the history of the world, do I have any right to speak about this story? Well, yeah, I do. It's about human experience, is what it is. We might not be slaves in the traditional sense of the word. We might not be slaves, but how many times have we found ourselves in that boat in the storm or in that little piece of land where there is no place to go, when there is no alternative, there is only violence on one side and death on the other? I mean, what are the choices sometimes that we have, and we find ourselves in this terrible, terrible bind, and we cannot see a way forward? And yet here, It's all about the story. That's why I think we miss the point if we go looking for where this happened. I'm not interested in where this happened out in the desert of Egypt. I'm not interested in where Mount Sinai is. I'm not interested in where the Hebrews lived in slavery in Egypt. You can go looking for all that kind of stuff. I'm not really interested in finding the little cradle that Jesus was born into. I'm not interested in finding the wooden cross that Jesus hung on and died. I'm not interested in that stuff. It's not helpful for me. What helps me are these stories of liberation, these stories of new possibility, these stories of transformation. Yahweh is a transforming God. That's what Yahweh is that power in life that transforms. That's what Yahweh is. And because Yahweh is that power in life that transforms, there will always be a way out. I might not see it at the moment. And sometimes the only way we can see a way out is to go back to these stories and read them and remember them, pray about them. Maybe there's a path staring us in the face right in front of us and we're not seeing it, but when we read a story like this, there it is. There it is. So how do you preach such a dramatic story as this? Wow. How do you talk about such a dramatic God as Yahweh? How do we rationalize these pathways that we have to follow in the future? How do we maneuver? How do we navigate? Well, the story has God leading these people, a column of smoke by day, a column of fire by night. I don't know. We don't have to get so literal, do we? No. Something is leading us. Something is guiding us. Now, the people in Bethlehem, they probably looked up at the sky at night and didn't see much. But there were three astrologers coming from the east who saw that star. They saw it. It guided them. They were looking for it. And you know why they saw it? Because they were looking for it. So there is a pathway forward. And these stories teach us what these pathways look like. They teach us what to look for. They teach us to see a star when there is a star there. They teach us to find a path when there is a path there. So for us, just like those people of Israel taking that first step, that's what we do. We take the next step, and the next step, and the next step. I joke about first coming to this church many years ago, and one of the pastors here in town was celebrating his 50th year in ministry, and I was having a terrible time here. Terrible. And I asked him, I said, what advice do you have for me? And he said, well, you keep putting one foot in front of the other. And I thought, what? Is that it? Is that? Oh, God. So here I am 30 years later saying to all of you, putting one foot in front of the other. That's an act of trust. Putting one foot in front of the other, in trust.
Will you join me in prayer? God of freedom, freedom through practice, freedom through choice and learning, freedom through trust. You are the keeper of history and the holder of all possibilities. You offer us walls on our left and walls on our right, a straight path toward a future of creativity, even when loneliness and fear and forces that would imprison chase after us. When the army of separation drives us from the homeland of our inherent goodness, you call us to return to our true selves, luring us to exit the prison of isolation in favor of the wide open freedom of connectedness in an economy of trust. God of discernment, you are with us like breath. You emerge from within us, part of us, innate and forceful, and yet we live in a world of war and division. This morning we pray for those in the world who are separated from us and from you by politics, history, economics, and prejudice. We pray for the women and men of our country and of all countries who are placed in harm's way by inequity and mistrust. We know that all people are one, part of the divine family, and we pray for the well-being of our friends and foes alike. May those who seek to harm us be guided toward the same wholeness that we pray for our children. And may those chosen to lead us be directed by respect and compassion for all life. God of grace, we so often feel your presence so strongly among us, and how lovely it is. We pray that you will continue to lead us toward a time and place where all people and all nations can trust that your principles of peace through justice bring true freedom rather than the drowning seas of violence and domination. In the face of fear or loneliness, as in times of joy and celebration, we put our trust in you, one step after the next. Unified as a family dedicated to peace, we pray as Jesus taught his disciples to pray, saying, "Our Father, who art in heaven, hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread, and forgive us our debts as we forgive our debtors. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom and the power and the glory forever and ever."